Understanding that that is in the process of implementation, so I don't suspect that the Design Commission has had the opportunity to address that issue. Whether they do, I mean, I know there are boards and commissions I have worked with, for example, the Charter Commission, that decided to provide both the majority and minority opinions on things, but I don't know that they've had the opportunity to consider that yet.
So is it your view, though, conceptually, that any written opinion by a commission member is part of the record before us?
Not unless it's placed before and not rejected by this body. The record consists of what's put in the record, and I just honestly don't know.
If that's not put in the record, it's not technically before. So
right.
the other option.
There's nothing, and I don't think there's necessarily anything that would prevent it from being placed in the record. I'm just not aware that there is such a thing.
Okay. And I guess the other issue is we frequently have hearings where members of the Design Commission testify. And nothing prevents a dissenting member of the Design Commission from coming to testify, does it?
I believe they have recently adopted new bylaws. I don't know that there's anything in there that speaks to that. I mean, there's nothing in our code that would prevent them from doing so, but I don't know whether there's anything in their bylaws that speaks to it again.
Mayor, the reason I raise this, obviously, is that by the time something comes to us and it's already had a hearing and a robust debate, I mean, I have always found it very useful to understand the thinking of the Design Review Commission. We have very thoughtful appointees who put a lot of time and energy, and it is fairly unusual to be told that the chair dissents on an issue. That I can't think of the last time that was a fact before us. And if that, if someone in the minority chose to write a report, it may or may not influence my thinking on the subject, but it would seem to me to be useful to have access to that so I could have the benefit of their thinking. And when people are testifying about someone's dissent, I'd actually, with all due respect, rather read the words of the person who wrote it and make my own judgment than hear secondhand. So I don't know how to address that, but because I don't think this has come up before.
So I was just thinking, and staff came up and had the same thought, which is that when you vote and it's not a unanimous decision, you all have the opportunity to say what you're thinking and why you're voting the way you are. The Design Commission does the same. One thing that is in the record are both the minutes and the tapes from the Design Review Commission's decision, and that is in the record, and you have the opportunity to review that as a part of your decision making here, and staff can make that available to you.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful.
Good. Thank you. Last two people, thank you for your patience. Would you like to start, please?
I'm Sherry Green. I live in the Pearl. I've lived in the Pearl since 1994, so I'm an old timer. And the one word I would like to speak about today is precedent. When I bought my house, I live on Irving, and everything behind me was just totally empty. I could see all the way to there was nothing in the Pearl. And I knew that, being a wonderful place that it was going to get developed. But I called the Planning Commission, and I said, I'm just curious as to what else you have planned. And I was told very succinctly that there was going to be a four-story limit of buildings in the Pearl. Now, this is 1994. I'm not really good at math, but I can sure count more than four, I'll tell you that. And my concern is that if this project passes as it is, it's setting a precedent. And it's a precedent I don't think we want to have. That's the only thing I have to say. Thank you.
Well said. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Rod O'Hearn. I've lived in the Portland metropolitan area for the last five decades. Thanks for the opportunity to voice our opinion. I agree with the chairman's decision on the negative impact that this will have on the Greenway. Not only do we enjoy the splendor that this particular area provides, the views, the walking paths, the bike paths, but all of our relatives that come into town, the people that we ask to come visit us, this is where we bring them, not only to the restaurants, to the different entities that our Portland provides, but the river. It's huge. Also, we spend a lot of time on the water, kayaking, boating, rowing. I wish I would have had made a picture of what it would look like from the water and the skyline. The reason myself and my gal live in this area is because the community, it's the people. They're kind, they're considerate, they're connected, and they care. I can fully understand why the developer sought for these modifications. There literally are millions of reasons why. Typically, I'll start with a dollar sign and end with a decimal point. Few people will actually benefit by this. The wealthy investors, the owners, and contractors for a short period of time. There's millions of reasons why. There's also millions of reasons why not. That's the people that live in Portland, the Portlanders, the people who enjoy this city. Every person that elected you to become the good stewards of our property and our environment. You are the caretakers of our community. Just like the caretakers from the past, the elected officials who designed the codes that are now in place, there's reason for those codes. It's to protect against the few. Now, we understand that we can't change progress or the condos or the development, but the so-called modifications, it's a very gentle word for what's happening, especially for such a dramatic impact to our city and the environment. So, we would urge you to be good stewards with our riverfront properties. We would urge you to be the elected officials and to make the right decisions for our community. Allowing the modifications is not being a good steward for us and our property and the community. It's likely that the day will come in your future when you're not in politics and you're walking along the riverfront and you will say to yourselves, with your kids or your grandkids, I made a choice. I made a good decision. We all, our community, will be better off without the modifications. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Thanks for your patience. Very good. Next, we will hear from the principal opponent. If my memory serves correctly, you have 17 minutes and 4 seconds. Name for the record, please. Thank you.
I'm Allison Reynolds with Perkins Coie, and we are land use counsel for the applicant, Lincoln Property Company. And today I've got with me Patrick Gilligan, who is with Lincoln Property Company. And after I'm done with this, he'll talk a little bit about Lincoln's investment in the city and this project specifically. And then also with me at the end of the table is Tim Wybanga with TVA Architects. And Tim has been the principal architect of this project and has really been sort of working with the neighborhood and the Design Commission on all the various changes that took place over about a year and a half period to try to bring this project to what it is today, which we think is something that provides a lot of public benefit and a great design for the site. My job here, I guess, is to talk a little bit about a couple of the legal issues that were highlighted by the appellants. And I won't go into a huge amount of depth with these today, but we did submit a written argument to you a couple of days ago that I hope you guys have. And if you have any additional questions, we're, of course, happy to answer those. So the first issue, I think, is one that you've heard a number of testifiers talk about today, and that is the floor area ratio calculation for the site. And so, as you probably know, under the development code, you have basically a size of a property, and then that gets multiplied by a number, and that equates to the amount of floor area that you can build in a building. And that, of course, has to, if you have a design overlay like this property does, go through discretionary design review. So just because you have it doesn't mean you can build it, but it does actually give you sort of a legal limit for how big the building can be. And so the first question about that was raised as to whether or not for calculating that size of the underlying property, the greenway setback and public plaza area should be contained as part of the site or excluded. And opponents of the project cited a code section that is actually not part of the code that governs this project. And so as you guys know, the code can change from the date of application to when you all actually are seeing this in an appeal setting. And so this project was submitted in November 2016, and the code section that was referenced is actually something that was adopted on March 31, 2017. And so that reference is something that you should just be aware does not actually apply here. And the code in effect at the time is clear that an ownership is what encompasses that site, and things like easements for the greenway or a public plaza that you provide on your site do not deduct from that total square footage. The second issue is one that is really in the legal weeds, and I will try to simplify this, but the question of exactly how far toward the river the site actually physically stretches. And opponents are correct that back in actually the 1800s, there was a determination by the Oregon legislature of where the state actually owns versus where private parties own. But there was actually a four-year period during which legislation dedicated that back to private property owners. And if you perfected your deed to your site during that time, you actually then own that little sliver between the ordinary low and the ordinary high. And that is the case for this property. We had discussed this at length with staff, and it was a big part of our due diligence because we do not want these folks to design a building that cannot actually be built on their site. And so we actually would like you to leave the record open until Friday so we can submit all of this material. We had discussed it with staff, and I believe they have it, but I don't actually think it's part of the formal record. And we, of course, want you to have the benefit of that for this appeal.
Could you stop the clock for a second?
Yeah.
I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
So, Could you go a few sentences deeper on that? So there was some time period by which the state granted property owners the ability to go all the way to the, I would assume, the low tide line. Is that correct?
Yep. And so
and
it was.
How long did that time period last, and when was that time period?
So that was between 1874, when the legislature enacted legislation which essentially deeded the submerged lands that are between ordinary high and ordinary low to the owners of the adjacent upland. And then they repealed that legislation in 1878. And so it is during that four-year period in the 1800s, if you actually perfected the deed to your property, you were governed under the law that was in effect and then was repealed.
So your contention, and you say you have the documents to back this, and I'll just trust you on this for the time being. So your contention is during that period between 1874 and 1878, whoever owned the land did in fact perfect the deed.
They did.
And that has been passed on.
Yep. And it has never been carved out.
Continuous change.
Yes, exactly. To eventually when Lincoln Property Company became the owner of the site.
All right, thank you. You can start the clock again. I was just curious.
No worries. So that is all I will say on that issue, but just know that it was fully vetted by our team, and we will provide those documents to you. The other two quick legal issues, first the locker room floor area ratio bonus. The code is clear that if you are in an EX or CX zoned site in the city and you meet the various requirements of that for a mixed-use building, a residential building, a commercial building, you are allowed to have a locker room and get a bonus for that for FAR. And we should just note, too, that we have one shower for male use and one for female use. We just kind of provided two, and then we have a few lockers associated with that, but it's no bigger than that. And so we feel that if restaurant employees or other employees of the building were to bike to work, that would probably be the primary users of those rather than folks that are actually in the units. But they would be available to anyone who used the building.
Could you stop the clock again? So the contention was made during testimony that, and I may have misheard the individual, so I apologize if I did, that you are required to store your bike in your apartment, or did I just mishear that?
I believe you. I don't know, actually, if you misheard it or not, but as far as what the code requires, the building is required to provide a certain number of long-term bicycle parking spaces, and those can be provided in your unit or in a sort of common area. And so this project actually provides one bicycle storage, I guess it's a rack that goes in the unit per unit, and then we will also have an additional bicycle storage area with places for more spaces.
Okay.
And the code actually requires more spaces than could fit in one per unit, so we're giving more than
okay,
that.
Okay, very good.
So just to be clear, your view is that under our code that applies, mm-hmm. your client is entitled to 175 feet.
For height?
For height.
So there is a modification that you can get under the code
right.
that would allow the design commission by finding that a height of 175 feet on this property better meets the design guidelines and is consistent with the purpose of the standard height here to be modified to grant that height. And I don't want to put words in the design commission's mouth, and I know that Tim can probably speak better to how that occurred, but that was the finding, that essentially a building with a podium and a tower that kind of swept sort of on one side of the bridge better met those guidelines than a 100-foot building would have been able to.
Okay, so it's not an entitlement, it's a discretionary action.
Yes.
And so we got a lot of testimony about the impact on the greenway. So how would this project be different if we preserved a 25-foot greenway?
So that's actually something that we also discuss in length in the legal submission that I sent in. And I think this staff also talked about this too. But just to make clear, there is a 25-foot setback from, I believe it's here, a seawall on this property that encompasses the greenway. Our project actually then sets back, I believe, another approximately 3.5 feet from that to the closest point of the project to that greenway. So we are preserving not only that required 25-foot greenway setback, but then an additional setback. The setback that is being modified for this particular property is actually an angle where once you have achieved 35 feet in height next to the greenway, you are supposed to step back 1 foot for every foot up you go. And so it essentially creates this 45-degree angle back from the greenway that your building elevation is supposed to meet. And this building is requiring a modification to that to allow essentially the building to kind of encroach into that little angle area.
But that step back would not address the concerns people have raised about the view from the north. From the southeast. That would affect the look of the building from the river and the step back.
So the modification is to that standard, the greenway step back for the North Pearl, and I believe the reason that that was actually done was to allow the building to have the orientation that it does in order to preserve those views. So it kind of works in context with the other modifications in order to place the building where it is and preserve the view that is being preserved.
And let me, since we have a lawyer here advocating for one side, let me ask you the question
yes.
that I asked the other side, which
sure.
is, in a transitional neighborhood where we know that many of the parcels are going to be redeveloped, mm-hmm. what is the appropriate definition of context?
And I mean, I think that is almost a harder question for a lawyer to ask than for a design professional. But here, I believe that we were thinking of context in sort of the developing nature of the North Pearl neighborhood, and not just looking at the buildings that are next to us, because these are not buildings that are I have no idea when they will actually redevelop, but it seems likely that they will redevelop in the future. And so part of the context, I think, is sort of that the neighborhood, it has come all the way up to NATO. And so making sure that we are integrating with both the things that are around, the way the river integrates with the project, and the other developments that are kind of part of the North Pearl but separated from this by NATO.
Okay, thank you.
All right. I think that's probably good for me. You've heard too much from the lawyer for a design review proposal. So I'm going to turn this
Can I ask one question before you
yes.
transition?
Commissioner Saltzman.
So you said the site development or the site area calculation
mm-hmm.
was changed in March 31st of 2017?
Not really. It's just that there is a code section that was added to the measurement section that is being relied upon by appellants when they make the argument that those areas should be taken out of the site. We actually would argue that under the code today and the code when this project was actually submitted, that both of those support our interpretation. But we were just pointing out that the argument is being made based on that code section, and that is not something that the council is able to consider because that is not a code regulation that applies to this project.
And you're saying there was it was a code interpretation in March of 2017?
It was actually through one of your code changes, the recap process. I believe it was recap 8, and that added a number of different sections to the zoning code. And so it was during that point that was added to the code. So it's a new code section completely. It does not exist in the code that's in effect for the application date of this project.
Okay, so in your opinion, then, the current definition of site area should include the Esplanade to the north and the Greenway section to the east?
Yes. In our opinion, the definition of site is an ownership, and the property owner here, Lincoln, owns both the area that has a Greenway easement on it and the plaza area that was in question.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. So with that, I will turn it over to Patrick Gilligan with Lincoln Property Company to tell you a little bit about his role, and then we'll move on to Tim Wybenga with TBA Architects. Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks, Allison. Mayor and Commissioners, thanks for your time today. So developer of the project, just gets to qualm a few rumors here. I'm a Portland resident, live five blocks away. I office across the street, oversee a local staff, about 25 people, and I'm responsible for roughly 50 buildings representing 4.5 million square feet in the Portland metro area. So I'm definitely here. This is home. This has been a really big project for us. We spent a lot of time. We set a goal of being transparent, working with staff, working with the design commissioners. And it's been a long battle, but we're really excited with the way it's come out and where the design we have today, and are excited to hopefully keep moving it forward. Other projects that we work on here and there, Wells Fargo Center, PacWest Center, again, this is home for us. So we're very committed to Portland and making the city a better place as much as we can through our projects. So thank you for your time, and I'll turn it over to Tim.
Excellent. Tim Wybenga with TVA Architects. As Allison said, I've been part of this project from the outset, and I'm going to kind of try and quickly go through a year and a half worth of process in the next 7 or 8 minutes, and then there are some pieces of information that are in the back of the printed packet and on the slides here that are really graphic illustrations that help represent some of the points that were made in public testimony. So if you have any specific questions, obviously we'll be happy to come back to those. First thing in general is just looking at the site. So this is a surface parking lot, right? So this is not a park. It's sort of an anomaly on the waterfront that we have two low-scale sort of suburban style office buildings and a large surface parking lot. So in the essence of the site, not to revisit this too often, but these diagrams that you've seen in other contexts really describe that the difference between, we've tried to be very clear about the difference between the allowable base height, base floor area, and that those pieces that are available to us through bonus and through modification. This just kind of gives a general look at that. From this general understanding of the allowable scale and volume of this, we did several studies and many, many studies. These diagrams show what's important about this. We've said from the outset, it's been quite clear, there is no protected view from Fields Park. There is no protected view really anywhere pertinent to this site. However, we recognize that what a lot of these people said at the outset and through the testimony is correct. This is an important part of Portland. And so from the beginning, we've said, let's see what we can do from a good neighbor standpoint from day one of this project to mitigate this without the requirement to do so. And so what you see in these studies, and you'll see throughout here, is that we took that view from Fields Park as being important and have studied the mass of the building. And so what's happened through the process is we've actually moved mass out of the podium, which would have more of a negative effect on that view, and pulled it towards the tower. And there's a few more things that we can kind of go through. This diagram is one that you may have seen previously. So, Ben put it in his presentation. This describes the project by right, which is the 100-foot red-orange block. And it describes, you can kind of see where the where we've moved volume out of that building into the tower element to to increase the visibility of the bridge. And again, this is from one specific vantage point. As you know, there just about every building in the Pearl and downtown obscures the bridge in some way. So most of our relationship with the bridge isn't a complete span of the arch until you get to the waterfront, and we'll kind of get to that as well. In terms of the process, and there's been a lot of, I think, mistruths being told in terms of the way this might have been pushed through or something else. We've met with the Pearl District Neighborhood Association, myself and my colleagues, four times for two and a half hours each time, talking through the minutiae of the project and the big vision as well. there's me presenting that same view diagram to the committee. So we've spent a lot of time on this with the neighbors, and did so not as a requirement because we wanted the neighbors to be on board and we wanted to get that input. Similarly, there's no shortage of public process besides pre-apps, and we've had a design advice review hearing, and we've had four public hearings. So no shortage of opportunity for public comment, and no shortage of iterations to go back and forth with the design commission. To that point, this next plan is actually the site plan as it existed at the time of our DAR. So there are some substantial changes here in the next couple slides that have to deal with our interaction with the design commission and also with the neighborhood. First and foremost is that in this plan we had a really a combined pedestrian auto court on the north side of this building to try and get resident vehicles into the building. And then to the east of that was essentially a lawn area. Secondly, the other thing that you'll see here is the Greenway Trail itself. So that represents the existing condition of the Greenway Trail, which at the time we were intending to leave. Another thing that came up, and I'll go through the... So this is where we ended up through the process. So what was a 10-foot public access to the river, combining cars and pedestrians, is now a 60-foot-wide major public space designed as a multi-use space to bring residents of the Pearl to the river and to bring activity to the river. Similarly, through our interaction with specifically with the PDNA, we went back on the plan of leaving the existing greenway condition, partly because it's not particularly friendly. And one of the primary things we got out of one of those meetings was the existing trees are riverward of the greenway. So the trees themselves become an obstruction. So in redesigning this, we've tried to prepare some or design something that will increase public amenity.
Can you keep this slide on for a second? So there's been a lot of comparisons to Riverfront Pearl. And I ride my bike through Riverfront Pearl a lot. Can you explain to us how bikes and pedestrians are meant to navigate this particular greenway?
I can. I also have another exhibit at the end that kind of describes the section. What I can tell you is that the existing greenway, right? The greenway is 25 feet wide as an easement. It's required to be a combination of plantings and hardscape. The existing hardscape at the narrow points between the tree well and the edge of walk is 12 and a half feet. So that entire stretch, which you've probably run or ridden your bike, about 1,100 feet here between this parcel and the Fremont Bridge, is to that same standard. So what we've done here is try to acknowledge the fact that we have a 13-foot minimum width, which we have gone through an iterative process with parks and with the neighborhood to get to that number, and a 18-foot average width. So 13 feet is at the pinch point, and part of what we're trying to do here, the greenway ends here currently. And so what we're trying to do from an urban planning and a design perspective is to provide something that deals with the fact that this is a transitional space, that for the time being, you know, a 25-foot wide sidewalk that goes and cuts off at the end, at the current end of the south side, essentially is one of those freeway off-ramps that never went anywhere, right? And so what we've tried to do instead is to say, design something that is has a better experience for pedestrians and for the neighbors. Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
So, and again, here's that existing condition. So the greenway itself, no eyes on it. It's adjacent to the surface parking lot, and the greenway trails ends there at the upper left of the site. So our proposal, and again, there's been a lot of talk about cutting off the river or not providing access to the river. I think this image essentially shows what we've come to through this process, which is a substantial 60-foot wide public space that directly links people from Nato Parkway and eventually to the Pearl to the river frontage, and an augmented design for the greenway itself that provides spaces for people to sit, congregate. It acknowledges the sort of temporary condition where the greenway is not improved to the south. This view is from the northeast. You can see the existing building there. So a lot of this stuff was developed over several meetings with the neighborhood and through several meetings, obviously, with the design commission. But we feel we're providing a huge public amenity. And again, if you compare this to any other project in the Pearl, sitting on a 200 by 200 block, there are generally zero public amenities. So there really has been a lot that's been provided here that's intended for that public benefit in order to justify some of the things that we've requested. Another thing in terms of the site plan that's really key, you can see someone mentioned earlier, this building and Nato Parkway are at a shift from the Pearl District grid of a little over 40 degrees. What that means is, I lost my page. What that means is we actually used this L-shaped tower, which the Design Commission gave us a lot of trouble about. Why is it an L? And the reason is it minimizes the sight lines. And so what you can see there, if you look at the length, top to bottom in this plan, that's the length extension. And the reason we requested that specific length is it doesn't change the vantage point from Fields Park. So we were able to put that some of that volume in the building in a place that takes into consideration the very viewpoint that people are so concerned about. I guess I would offer this one to show the context. What you can see here is this is a building in and of the Pearl. The tower element itself, in terms of the question of context, this tower belongs in the Pearl. Most of the towers in the Pearl are substantially larger than this. In terms of stepping down to the river, you can see that through our process with the Design Commission, it substantially steps down to the river. In terms of its context with adjacent buildings, it has the same relationship to the greenway and to the river as the existing adjacent facilities.
So could you stop the clock for a second? So there's been a lot of discussion about this notion of context.
Right.
What does it mean to you as an architect? As you're looking at this building, and I heard what you just said in terms of the size of the other building, what does it mean?
When these questions come up, I always remember what my dad said to me when he told me not to go into architecture school, which is that I was leaving engineering where facts were quantifiable into a field where everybody got an opinion. And it's true, right? This is all highly subjective. And so what I would say in terms of context is not the same as what someone else would say. What we've tried to do here is to balance context in terms of both the fact that this is sitting in the largest, most highly developed residential neighborhood in the city, and it sits on the waterfront. So the scale cues and the material cues of these podium elements are taken directly from the flour mill at Centennial Mill. They're taken from Albers Mill. That's the scale. That's sort of the repetition of these masonry elements that ties into, you know, if you picture Albers Mill, you picture the flour building at Centennial Mill. There's a regularity and a repetition. And we've tried to nest those two things together and acknowledge that the context of this building is actually certainly of two or many more minds. And we've tried to meld both the modernity of the towers in the Pearl together with something that is contextual in its texture, scale, and placement.
Thank you.
So I'll keep going through here. Just in general, and you can look at these things in your packet, these are all the public amenities we're talking about. This was designed in conversation with the Design Commission. They really wanted something more. And that was the same we heard from the PDNA. Yeah, okay, this is good. We want something more. We want something extra. And what we got to, in addition to the 60-foot wide plaza space, was the idea of kind of creating this head condition at the intersection of the greenway and this new plaza. It's a space where people can come, congregate, potentially use it as an amphitheater, a spot for a lecture, or just to sit and enjoy the view and the river, and the bridge, of course.
Can I ask you a question about this public plaza? Whose responsibility is the management of this plaza?
Unfortunately,
that's ours.
I'm sorry.
It's a developer. It's still our property.
So you're responsible for keeping a clean security and all that?
Yeah, and we've been doing it on that site for a long time now since we've owned it.
Very good. Thank you.
I laughed because that's been a point of contention between Patrick and me. The more evolved the public spaces get, the more his team has to manage.
Understood. Thank you.
So I'll continue on here. This view actually shows what is currently the terminus of the greenway. And so this is an area where the greenway expands by another 15 or 16 feet over the required amount. And the idea is we're trying to create something here that at the time, that's current time, is a terminus of that greenway from north to south. But it's something that kind of becomes a knuckle or a joint for the future development. So it becomes a pause point in the future. These are all sort of just urban design concepts. The other thing that's come out of our conversations with the PDNA and with the Design Commission is we've actually gone and incorporated some units, so direct eyes on the greenway. So we're thinking these are probably short-stay units at the outset of the project for very practical reasons of this sort of being the end of the run. We had mechanical space there. That wasn't okay with the PDNA. Probably wasn't the best decision from an urban design perspective, so we've gone around in detail to kind of create something that's a little more energetic. And of course, one thing we haven't talked much about, I guess, is the what's shown here in the center of this image. We do think it's important that there are places for people to get out on the river. We think it's important that there are different types of activities on the river. So this dining space, which the owner has encouraged us to do to help activate riverfront, to get more eyes on the greenway, to get more people to the water, is something that we incorporated after our first couple hearings with the city, and we think it adds a real vibrancy, a real livability component to this project.
Is there an existing condition of approval that requires the public space be open to the public 24/7?
Do you know that?
I believe this is just out of the code, and so there is no condition of approval that's associated with that, but I believe that was the intention. Because it is a public plaza, it will not be in any way confined from the public, that it be open at all times.
So we've clarified that in prior decisions in two instances where we've had that representation made in the record, and if necessary, made it as a condition of approval. But it's your understanding that the code requires it be open 24/7?
I am not. I don't want to speak to something and be incorrect, and so I don't actually know the answer to that, but I believe that is our intention, and so if that was something that isn't in the code that you guys do want clarified, then we would be, I believe, able to accept a condition.
Yeah, Allison, I believe the current, there is an easement on the greenway right now that they're on the other part of the property, and it's, I think, and again, across other points on the greenway, that it's, I think, 5 a.m. to 10 p.m., mm-hmm. the hours of use. That's just the signage that we've seen in that area so far.
Yeah,
so.
And I believe that's specific to the greenway versus this actual public plaza area.
The public plaza purports to be a public amenity, and the land is used to calculate the extra height. So I think it's a relevant question about whether there are any restrictions placed on the public access to that site.
Yes, and we would be happy to look into that and get back to you. For your question, I believe we would be acceptable, a condition of that nature would be acceptable if it's not already required by the code. So either way, we're happy to provide that as a 24-hour amenity if needed.
Excellent. So I will try to leave a little bit of time here. We have plenty of things here. If you want to talk about context, you want to ask us any more specific questions, we can kind of go through these at the end. These just give a general idea of what's most been evolved in this building over the course of all those meetings with the PDNA and all those meetings with the Design Commission is a focus on the human-scaled public access pieces. And that's hopefully evident through what we've done here, and we've spent a lot of time on it. We believe this is a huge amenity for the area, and we really believe this is the right building for the right space. And so I'll leave it there. If you have any questions on any of the specific appeal issues, I can try and flip to those.
I have a couple of questions. So with regard to the greenway, the width of the greenway walk, it is your contention there is no encroachment?
Absolutely not. And I should have addressed that. There's, I actually understand, having sat through even the most recent neighborhood meeting to try and listen in and see what the issues are, I understand why people are really upset, because this has been conveyed that the city has given city property, public property, park property to a developer, which is not the case. There's a 25-foot greenway. There's still a 25-foot greenway. We don't encroach on that width at all. In fact, it's slightly bigger in numerous places. And the width constriction issue with that we dealt with most substantially with the Neighborhood Planning and Transportation Committee was the question of how wide is the actual walking surface. One of the appellants mentioned the Parks District. Well, the Parks District has requirements for this space, which include landscape standards. Right? So it's not acceptable to build a 25-foot wide sidewalk, besides the fact that it's not particularly appealing. So we've really tried to work, as we have with the mass of the building, to kind of control the movement of people and to create a space that's beautiful and appealing, whether or not there are people in it or it's completely packed. So that's where that width question, the only valid width question I think comes from, is 13 feet too narrow? When we first went to the neighborhood, we had a 10-foot section, which we thought was the, again, this is not the greenway, it's the paved portion of the greenway. It's always been 25 feet. So the question is, where we have landscape areas and it necks down, what's the right number? And we settled on 13, which is wider than most of what exists there today.
So somebody gave a very reasoned argument around the exaggeration of the buildable site, and I think it was proffered that you have exaggerated by 70% the buildable. What is your reaction to that?
That's actually, I presume what they're saying is germane to what Allison addressed earlier, which is that the contention is that the site area, to get to that number, and I'm not sure how they would get to that number, but it means you'd have to take any part of the site that the public can use and subtract it out of the owned area of the site. So the entire public amenity of that plaza would be taken out, the greenway would be taken out, any other property that doesn't have a building on it. I think the contention is that that's not buildable area and doesn't count towards the site. I think that's what we understand the case they're making, but that certainly isn't the way this has been interpreted in any other project we've ever been a part of.
Very good.
Mayor, can I jump in for a second?
Please, Commissioner Fish.
I understand that one of the three bases for your bonus height is an eco-roof?
Yes.
And is it my assumption is that the standard for the eco-roof is not the current standard that the Commissioner Udaly has put into 2035, but is the pre-existing standard?
I would say yes.
So we've substantially tightened the requirement to expand the footprint, and I assume you're using the old standard for the eco-roof?
Yeah, that's correct, based on the code that's in applicable to this project. So it would be the 2016 code.
I'm looking at page 21 of this beautiful handout you gave us. And can you tell me off of that picture what actually constitutes the green roof and what is the kind of large rectangular space on the short portion of the building?
Sure. I should say our team member who did these beautiful images is sitting here, and he's probably panicking because these would fall into the artist's rendition more than precise drawings. But they're based on our model, so they're actually quite close. What's shown there very diagrammatically, the green space on top of that lowest podium, everything shown in green, it's actually a breakdown. Some of that actually fits the definition. It's all planted, but some of it doesn't fit the definition of green roof per the code. The tan-colored space is a terrace. And so there's actually another terrace that kind of wraps around. You can see a little bit of it here on the shoulder on the southeast corner. There's kind of a split between occupied terrace and green roof. What we elected to do with the green roof is to not put it in places where it wouldn't grow or wouldn't be seen, like in the mechanical well at the top of the building. So we've tried to mix that in with landscaping and with spaces that can be occupied.
Very good. Commissioner Saltzman, anything else before we move to the next group?
I was just curious, is this building going to meet a particular LEED standard?
There's no LEED certification plan for this building.
Commissioner Fish, I just did a quick search of the code, and I don't believe that the plaza has any sort of requirement regarding 24-hour access. So if that is a condition of approval that you would like to add to this, we are happy to craft one of those for you if that would be helpful.
Get to that later. Thank you.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
So I try to keep all of my comments germane to the hearing and to the parameters of the hearing. So I will just say this. I hope you will reconsider that LEED standard. If for no other reason than I think that's what the market is looking for.
Right.
But I realize that's not necessarily germane to this particular hearing. Rebuttal. No, wait. Opponents of the appeal. 3 minutes each. How many people do we have signed up?
We have 5 people.
Very good. You can cool your heels for a little bit and think about your desire for LEED certification.
Thank you, Commissioners.
First three are Madeline Kovacs, Alan Kessler, and Patricia Gardner.
No, I agree with you. Yeah, I think we should do that. Are you all ready to go?
Okay.
Great.
Okay.
3 minutes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, Commissioners. My name is Madeline Kovacs, and I am testifying today for the members of Portland for Everyone in support of the Fremont Apartments Project and in opposition to the appeal request by the Pearl District NA. I begin by asking Council to please keep in your thoughts during these proceedings all of those Portlanders who are desperately seeking housing, are currently working, or don't have the time or the resources to come and testify before you today.
Excuse me, folks. You heard the rules right up front. And I made it very clear that you were going to hear opinions that were different than your own. And you heard people listening to your position respectfully. You need to do the same. Otherwise, you will be asked to leave. Please continue.
The developers on the Fremont Apartments actively engage with the neighborhood, adapting plans that are allowed outright under Portland code to address local concerns and on due diligence. Plans were amended multiple times to accommodate concerns. Current condo residents fighting apartment towers similar to the ones they live in and that were allowed at the time they move in is ironic. We must also be clear about what is under consideration today and what is not. View corridors were established by an arduous long-range planning process, and the views discussed today in relation to this project were not among them. I would be remiss if we did not note that Portland for Everyone would support the project even more enthusiastically if the team had opted not to include parking and had instead opted involuntarily to the city's new inclusionary housing program. That said, we need more housing of all stripes and projects that meet land use and design requirements, provide enhanced public benefits, must be allowed to be built. This is also a key point for those concerned with protecting Portland's most vulnerable residents and other places from further displacement. As the White House said a few years ago in its housing development toolkit, when new housing development is limited region-wide, and particularly in neighborhoods with political capital to implement stricter local barriers, the new housing that does get built tends to disproportionately concentrate in low-income communities of color, causing displacement and concerns of gentrification in those neighborhoods. Portland City Council must be steadfast in demonstrating leadership and making decisions that will support our city's stated vision for the future. We must consider this and all projects cumulatively, and in light of our stated long-range planning goals, the Climate Action Plan, the Comprehensive Plan, Equity and Anti-Displacement Goals. We must ensure that the continued build-out of Portland's urban core while enabling walking, biking, and the use of transit, a proposal to build hundreds of units in our downtown core on an empty parking lot, accomplishes our public policy goals for public health, climate mitigation, and affordability. Portland is in a declared housing crisis, but we did not get here overnight. Part of the solution is strengthening tenants' rights, Part of the solution is securing more funding for affordable housing, and part of the solution is making sure that we do not continue to chronically underbuild housing, especially in our best connected places, if we are serious about addressing this issue. As a city, we must choose to live out our values and prioritize housing our full community over the objections of a few individuals, probably on every project.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Alan Kessler. I'm here to support the project. This is an extraordinary waste of time. It's an extraordinary waste of money. Counsel for appellant is very good at what she does. She's not cheap. The architects here are very good at what they do. They're not cheap. And to bring them through four rounds of design review, four voluntary meetings with the neighborhood, and then for council to, you're required to entertain and understand, but if you were to override the will of the design committee, that's at an expense that any developer coming to the city has to expect will happen to them. So then the calculation on should we build more needed housing in Portland includes this expected cost of hiring attorneys, hiring architects to come to meeting after meeting after meeting, only to be told by council, no, go back to design review and negotiate this some more. This is a process committed over and over again throughout the country in every neighborhood, every community. No neighbor wants more people near them. But this has led to the development patterns we have. This is why we have a need for the affirmatively forwarding fair housing laws and other things to sort of remediate the economic and ability segregation that's been part of the makeup of the way that American cities are built. I would note that each and every one of these units is likely to be Type B ADA or Type B accessible. 2% of them will probably be required to be Type A accessible. So this is 175 accessible units that some neighbors who don't want the view out of their condo to change are coming to you know, they hope to defeat it to make sure these units don't get built. We have an obligation under federal law. We have a moral obligation to have more housing for people with disabilities. We have an obligation, a moral obligation, to create more housing, period, because that's the only way we're going to get through this affordability crisis. So I would ask council to not just deny the appeal, but I would ask you to send a message to neighborhood associations who would leverage ONI resources and their position within the coalition to try to stop needed housing and try to stop accessible housing in the future. I think you should deny this outright in extremely clear terms and make it clear that in the future, neighborhoods can't abuse this process to stop our city from developing the buildings that it needs. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Hi. My name is Patricia Gardner. I was fortunate to live in the Pearl District since 1993 and just recently moved out. And I have to say I'm kind of a little surprised to be here because I haven't even finished unpacking. But that said, I need to clarify some history and legacy. A lot of the appellants talked about precedent, and I've got some bad news for them. The precedent they're talking about was planned. It's exactly, this building is exactly what was planned. It is what is in code. And the reason I can say that is I was the planning chair who went through the North Pearl plan, and I sat there and I advocated for this. Our model was not San Francisco, which sprawls forever. Our model was not Chicago, which sprawls forever. Our model was Vancouver, bluntly. And this was the place where the River District via the Pearl District was going to reach out and grab the river. And the reason the setback is 25 feet is because we wanted buildings there and we wanted urban buildings there. And that's what the code says because that's what we planned on doing. And that was passed in the mid-2000s and the design guidelines were updated as part of that process. And so what you see in front of you is exactly what the plan was. The Pearl was not supposed to stop at the Fields Park. There was supposed to be a bridge that blocked your view of everything in the Fields Park that brought you to the river. This is in the Peter Walker Master Plan. This is in every plan that's been done in the Pearl. You were supposed to go to the river and look at the river. You weren't supposed to stop in the Fields Park. You were supposed to go to the river. And you were supposed to go to restaurants, and it wasn't supposed to be privatized. It was supposed to be a place that all Portlanders could use. And so, yeah, they're 100% correct. You are creating precedent, and you are creating the precedent that was planned. And if you don't do this, you're going to get a lot of people going, well, I don't want two-story buildings, or I don't want three-story buildings, and so why don't we make it a park? And I'm sure, you know, Commissioner Fritz would have a problem when people are coming to ask for park money for, you know, what we want. And so I think that you're right. It's a turning point. Do you support the plans and the zoning codes that have been done over the past 25 years? Because this is what you got, because this is where it was headed to the whole time. Thank you.
Patty, can I ask you a question? Because you've waited a long time, and you haven't been able to unpack. So, and thank you for your letter. But let's concede everything you say in your letter. Just speaking for this member of this body, which by law has to review a decision when it's brought to us. If I agreed with everything in your letter, I think you and I would still agree that it is our function as a council to make sure the public is getting a meaningful greenway and that it is accessible. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I think you would all agree you'd want us to make sure. We'd want to generally make sure it's a building that's well-designed, although I don't set myself up as the arbiter of that generally. But and this council has been extremely flexible on design issues. We've actually gone against the design commission a couple of times just to incentivize use of new and innovative materials. I think that you would want us, as the mayor just did, to probe the question about could this project be greener? Now, we may or may not have the legal right to push it through this proceeding, but the fact that this is not a LEED, you know, gold or not LEED anything is of some concern because our climate action standards amended. We've tightened up our code requirements for eco roofs accordingly. And I think you'd want us to be looking at the question of who's being served by the building. Now, I generally subscribe to the idea that more product over time is going to be good because there'll be inevitably market corrections, and we've also got to have a variety of housing. I am concerned that 95% or more of the housing we're building is luxury housing that is out of sync with the ability of the people that both of you have spoken about, and that might even be covered by federal law and fair housing, can afford. So I'm a little chagrined that there's been this huge rush to put permits in to get around IZ. That's a huge missed opportunity. And there was no way around it. We couldn't make it retroactive. But the 15,000 to 20,000 units will not be affordable under our new law because of it. So I just want to say, in respect, I think, you know, Patty Gardner's come before us many times. She has lots of important things to say. But even if I agree with everything in your letter, I still think we have a role to play in making sure it's good design, it's as green as possible, that the public amenities are truly public and accessible, and to push a little bit on affordability, because this, to my knowledge, is not an affordable development. It's not required to be, but I think it is our role to flag that issue from time to time.
So a couple thoughts. One, I would ask the developer, could they meet LEED standard? One thing that you should know about LEED is it's wicked expensive.
Really. Or an alternative. I know there's other...
It's expensive. And so, you know, the fact that they have a green roof, the fact that they have bicycle parking, I bet you if they did the math, you know, went through the little check sheet that LEED had, I wouldn't be surprised if this building actually meets it. And so that's one question I would ask the developer, because when you're doing a development, it's expensive, and that $200,000 that's not a small sum, and that's what it basically costs. So that's one thing I would say. The other thing I would say is one interesting side effect. So I had to live in an apartment building. I'm going to tell you a short story. I had to live in an apartment for the last 3 years. And what I found is that because of all the housing that's coming on board, there are a lot. People aren't raising their rents. They're lowering their rents. There are, like, people are giving months and months of rent away. The one bonus that I don't know if you're aware of is by all the housing coming online, I think you're going to find rents fall. And so it may not meet low income, but it could potentially meet workforce. And that is something that we are also woefully under we don't have enough workforce housing, and we really don't have enough workforce housing in the downtown core. And I think if you were to do a survey of the apartments in the Pearl, I think it would be very interesting to see where their rents have gone over the last year. So that's just something to keep in mind from a context point of view.
Yeah, and Patty, thank you for the clarification on LEED standards, since I opened that can of worms. You are correct. For me, it's really about the outcomes, not so much the nice medallion, although it is pretty. It really is about the outcomes, and as Commissioner Fish correctly pointed out, we have aggressive climate action standards for this city, and that means everybody needs to do their part, and we have an opportunity.